Artemis 2 lifts off for the moon. Galaxies found without dark matter. A comet slows down and reverses its rotation. And antimatter goes for a ride. And in Spaceflights Plus, how humanity is slowing down the rotation of the Earth. All this and more in this week's Spaceflights. After a series of delays, Artemis 2 blasted off. Now, the Space Launch System launched from the Launch Pad 39B at the Kennedy Space Center at 6:35 local time in Florida. On board, we've got four astronauts, Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Cook, and the Canadian astronaut, Jeremy Hansen. Yes, I'm excited that there's a Canadian astronaut going around the moon. I am completely biased, and that's fine. So, this is the second mission as part of the Artemis program. You know, obviously the first one was the one that we saw, I don't know, 50 years ago, maybe, where you had an uncrewed Orion capsule go around the moon. It spent the better part of a month in the environment around the moon, and then it came back home. This time, they're just going straight to the moon, falling back down to the Earth. They're doing a flyby. They're doing a recreation of the Apollo 8 mission. They're demonstrating that all of the life support on this capsule works as planned. We got the launch yesterday. They took off. They went into orbit and did a pair of maneuvers that were designed to circularize the orbit and get it in preparation for a translunar injection. As they were in between one of the orbital operations and another one, they got a warning light telling them that their toilet was offline. This is a disaster. But the good news is they were able to get it operational again. And so they will have a toilet for their mission to the moon. And so Thursday night, they performed a 5-minute, 49-second burn that changed their velocity and put them into a translunar injection to go to the moon. Just to give you a sense of the overall timeline, they launched on Wednesday, and then Thursday night, they did the translunar injection. Then it's going to take them 3 days to get to the moon. Then they're going to fall back to the Earth 3 days after that. And so the whole mission is going to take about 10 days. But a week from now, on next week's Space Bites, the mission will almost be over, which is very different from the Artemis 1 mission, which went on for week after week after week. Obviously, this is very exciting. This is the farthest that humans have been from the Earth in nearly 6 decades. We are going back to the moon. And hopefully, this time, it'll be to stay. NASA announced that they're working on a new drone program that's going to be going to the moon. They're calling it Moonfall Drones. And I'm sure you're thinking, wait a minute, how can drones work on the moon? There is no atmosphere there. And you are right, there is no atmosphere. So instead, these will be autonomous hoppers that will be filled with fuel, and then they will hop across the surface of the moon. Each one of these hoppers potentially can go an entire 50 kilometers distance. And so they will probably do a cycle of about 150 seconds where they take off the surface of the moon, travel horizontally, maybe up to a distance of about a kilometer off the surface of the moon, and then come back down, land, and then do another hop. And with each one of these hops, they will be able to cross all of the intervening nasty terrain, all of the ravines and the boulders and so on, but also give really high resolution images of the terrain that's around them. And of course, this is going to be really useful for future missions where you're actually going to have humans that are going to be navigating around looking at the interesting spots, especially, say, the permanently shadowed craters on the moon. And one of the big challenges NASA is looking at is how do you make these things survive the lunar night? We know that the 14 days of dark and cold is a death sentence for many of the missions that go to the moon. But this is just one example of the fleet that NASA is planning on sending to the moon. We talked about this last week, that NASA is planning on sending dozens of robotic landers to the moon over the next year. You know, this is part of their ignition program. We should see a lot more of these kinds of announcements over the coming year. Really interesting landers, rovers designed to help map and prepare the way for a human return to the moon. Astronomers using the Hubble Space Telescope have found a comet that has slowed down its rotation, stopped, and then sped up in the opposite direction. The comet is called 41P Tuttle Gyakobini-Krychek, or 41P for short. This comet started out in the Kuiper Belt, and then about 1,500 years ago, it ended up in its current orbit that is bringing it into the inner solar system. Probably kicked into its current orbit by Jupiter. Hubble also measured the size of the comet, only about a kilometer across, so it's not very big. And so now it takes about 5.4 years to orbit around the sun, bringing it to its closest point in the solar system. And so astronomers were watching it during the last close passage, the one back in 2017, and they could see that its rotation was slowing down. And then they did follow-on observations with the Hubble Space Telescope, and it was now spinning in the opposite direction. And so what must have happened is that there are jets on the comet that start to blast out material as the comet gets closer to the sun as it heats up. And so one of these jets was pushing it from the side, and that caused it to slow down the rotation that it was doing till it stopped and then start to go in the new direction that the jet was pushing it in. And this process has been theorized, but now we're sort of seeing this in real time. And it's believed that this could be the reason why some comets get destroyed. They've got some kind of jet that is not balanced, spins the thing up, it starts spinning so quickly that it eventually tears its nucleus apart, and then it just is gone. Imagine what the hype would have been if Comet 3i Atlas had done that, had had a new jet show up and changed its spin rate. I'm sure we would still be talking about it. But yet, this is a thing that comets can do. So don't be surprised if an interstellar object does something like this too. Dark matter is the majority of the mass in most galaxies, but we are learning that it's not evenly distributed, that there are galaxies with an overabundance of dark matter in them and galaxies with almost no dark matter in them. And the evidence for this comes from gravitational microlensing. You can see how the gravity of the galaxy is bending the light, allowing you to calculate how much mass is in it. You can count up the stars and you can figure out how much dark matter remains. And in 2018, astronomers found a really strange galaxy called NGC 1052 DF2. This galaxy seems to contain only stars and not very much dark matter. In fact, it doesn't contain a lot of stars either. You can actually see galaxies through this galaxy. And when they calculated the amount of dark matter that was present in this galaxy, they found there was very little. And this is sort of a blow against this alternative theory to dark matter, which is called MOND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics. The idea is that, you know, we just don't understand how gravity works at the largest scales, that the way you can explain the rotation curves of galaxies, you just add extra parameters to gravity at the larger scales, and you can sort of change the math, and that explains them. But that assumes that you're going to have the same amount of this modified gravity just to go along with whatever is the mass of the galaxy. But you've got these situations where there are galaxies with very little dark matter. And so they're calling this the bullet dwarf. And this is a reference to the bullet cluster, which is this famous example of galaxy clusters where the dark matter and the stars and the gas have been stripped away from each other. And so in the bullet cluster, the way this works is you have these clusters of galaxies that fell into each other. And because the stars are these points, they very rarely will actually collide with each other. And so the stars pass right past each other, like clouds of bees. The dark matter has no cross-section either, and so the dark matter passes through itself as well. But the gas does have a cross-section. The gas piles up in the places where these galaxies are colliding. And then later on, that gas turns into stars. So you essentially have dwarf galaxies that have no dark matter in them because the dark matter passed through itself and it didn't pile up in the place where this gas is. And so now astronomers have found another example of this that is a little bit closer to home. And in fact, they found a string of these ultra-diffuse galaxies, which are essentially galaxies made from the combined gas when there was some kind of collision. And what the astronomers think is that there was this really high velocity collision between two galaxies, where one galaxy plunged through another galaxy. And the gas in the main galaxy and the galaxy that collided with it then left behind these pockets of gas. And then those pockets formed stars, but there's no dark matter in them. And so now we're seeing more and more examples of this, you know, disconnection between the overall mass of the galaxy, the amount of dark matter that's in a galaxy, and the amount of stars and the amount of gas, and showing that these things can be separated from each other in ways that makes it really hard to explain with modified Newtonian dynamics, and gives a lot more evidence towards dark matter as some kind of particle. And we've got a story about this from Andy Thomaswick. Astronomy is a science that produces just insane amounts of data. I mean, we've been talking a lot about how Vera Rubin is going to be dumping terabytes of data every day out onto the internet that people are going to have to comb through. 800,000 alerts of things that have changed just in that one night. It's too much for astronomers to keep on top of. But astronomers are often programmers and have developed a bunch of machine learning algorithms to stay on top of this. And so they've trained computers to be able to search for the kinds of things that they're interested in. And one is exoplanets. So we've had examples where astronomers have looked through archival information from old missions like Kepler and dug up hundreds, if not thousands, of potential exoplanetary candidates. And now astronomers have developed a custom machine learning algorithm for NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, the TESS mission. And so the system is called RAVEN. It stands for the Ranking and Validation of Exoplanets. And astronomers used RAVEN to scan through all of the data that TESS has sent back home to Earth so far. You're looking at transiting information for over 2 million stars. And they found, by digging through all of those data with this machine learning algorithm, they found over 100 newly validated planets and over 2,000 potential candidate exoplanets. And so it just shows that for every challenge in astronomy, there's probably a machine learning algorithm that needs to be developed to help look through all of those data and find the answers. And this is great because now TESS is catching up to Kepler in the amount of exoplanets that is turning up. And it was built at a fraction of the price of the Kepler mission. And so it's just demonstrating how good of a mission that is and how it is going to give us, hopefully, many, many more exoplanetary candidates. We've got a story about this from Evan Goff. So if you watched the movie Project Hail Mary, they have this organism called the astrophage that is very powerful, stores a lot of energy. And this is kind of an analogy for antimatter, which is a thing that we know stores a lot of energy, where if you combine antimatter with matter, you get annihilation at this pure E equals MC squared. You get this release of gamma radiation, effectively turning the mass directly into energy. Antimatter is very useful, and it is very complicated and expensive to produce. And in some cases, where you're producing the antimatter is not where you want to run your experiments with the antimatter. You need to move it. But the challenge is, how do you move a thing that if one particle of antimatter touches a particle of matter, it annihilates and it's gone? Places like CERN, they actually have what they call the antimatter factory, where they actually produce particles of antimatter. Now, the challenge is that you are producing this antimatter as the result of a collision between particles. And so things are moving very, very fast. And they actually have two devices attached with that. One is called the antiproton decelerator, and they have the extra low energy antiproton ring. So they are catching these particles of antimatter, slowing them down, and then putting them carefully into this trap that they can then use for experiments later. And they've actually kept antimatter in storage for up to a year and then using it in an experiment later on. So we're getting much better at manipulating antimatter. And so scientists at CERN have built a containment facility. It allows them to put antimatter into a magnetic trap that's super cooled and allows them to actually move the antimatter around. And they did a demonstration where they put this antimatter trap into a truck, drove it across the facility at CERN, pulled it out, took it into a different instrument, and were able to actually use the antimatter. And this is a demonstration, a sort of a proof of concept that you can actually take antimatter on the road with you. I mean, you put antimatter into a container, what could possibly go wrong? And if this works, then you can take this stuff even farther. You can take this, say, hundreds of kilometers from where it's being produced in something like, say, the Large Hadron Collider to another facility where you need to be able to work with it and do experiments. But the part that I think is really exciting is that You know, if we want to build, say, interstellar spacecraft, we need to be able to produce antimatter at scale, store it, and then move it onto our spaceship, and then take our spaceship to another star system, all the while not letting this antimatter touch the side of the containment bottle and be able to pull it out as we need to be able to accelerate our spacecraft. And so is this us moving towards our interstellar future? Who knows? But it's very cool that they're moving antimatter. Every week we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best space news story of the week. And the winner last week was NASA's ignition announcement. So thank you everyone who voted last week. Once again, we will put the vote for this week's stories up onto the post tab the same time that we post the video. Go in there, find this poll, vote, and let us know what you thought was the best story of the week. Now, of course, the best chance to see these polls is subscribe to the channel. Click on the notifications bell. Obey the algorithm. One of the problems with launching satellites is that they can run out of propellant. The entire satellite is working fine. All of its instruments are still going, but it no longer has the propellant for station keeping, for orientation, and so it's effectively dead. But various companies have been working on ideas to be able to refuel satellites. Now, these have been done through various state operations, but now a private Chinese company has demonstrated some of the underlying technology to be able to refuel a satellite in space. So the company's called Sustain Space, and they launched their new satellite, which is called the Xiyuan Zero, on March 16th, 2026. And, you know, this wasn't actually refueling any existing satellite, but it was demonstrating a bunch of the maneuvers. So it's got this refueling arm, and they pulled it out and had it go through a bunch of the operations that it would go through in refueling. So it's testing out methodologies for in-space servicing and refueling. They had a little mascot on board from Weibo, which is a Chinese, it's like Chinese Twitter. And then once all of the tests are complete, they're going to inflate an airbag, a drogue chute, on the spacecraft that will then cause it to deorbit rapidly and burn up in the atmosphere. And so this is sort of like a first test for how you could start to refuel satellites privately. You can imagine this future where some satellite company have got a multi-million dollar satellite that is working well, but it is out of fuel. And so they can call for a refueling mission. Spacecraft will show up, deliver more propellant to the spacecraft, and then deorbit itself to get out of the way and not create more space junk. When there's a permanent human presence on Mars, what are they going to eat? Now, if you've watched The Martian, you probably remember the poop potatoes that he had to grow. And this is because while there is the regolith, which is the crushed up rock on Mars, you don't have the organisms in the soil that plants need to be able to survive. And so you need to generate some kind of organic material. And in The Martian, it was poop. But there's probably cleaner ways to be able to do this. So researchers in Germany came up with an experiment where they wanted to see if they could use cyanobacteria to generate fertilizer. And they actually grew duckweed using simulated regolith, which had been fertilized with cyanobacteria. So with just a gram of cyanobacteria in this regolith, they were able to grow 27 grams of duckweed. So you can imagine this cycle where they have like a cyanobacteria digester where they put in a bunch of regolith, they mix it with the cyanobacteria. The cyanobacteria starts to get the soil biology going. Then they take that and they use that as a growing medium for other plants, like the kinds of crops, or maybe potatoes that humans would want to eat, where you didn't have to sort of deal with the human poop. They'll feed the poop to the cyanobacteria, but not necessarily to the people. We've got a story about this by Lawrence Tognetti. And in fact, if you're interested in this subject, I just did an interview with Dr. Corinne Bakermans about how Mars regolith simulant is actually kind of toxic to various Earth life forms. And so what will it take for us to be able to take this raw material and turn it into something that we can actually grow food in? And so that interview is probably going to be showing up in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. And that's why you should subscribe. And finally, we've got some beautiful pictures. And this is a series of images which are taken by the Chandra X-ray Observatory, as well as other observatories like Hubble, James Webb, Spitzer, so on. And this is a series of images focusing on stellar nebulae. So these are places where new stars are forming. And the Chandra portion of these images is in purple. This is the X-ray radiation that is coming from these new stellar nurseries, the really hot X-ray radiation. So we've got the Pelican Nebula, the Cat's Paw Nebula, NGC 346, the Flame Nebula, Westerland 2, and Cygnus OB3. And these images are roughly sorted by age, but in general, all of these images contain stars that are in the first couple of million years of life. And this is the kind of stellar nursery that the sun and the solar system formed in 4.5 billion years ago. We've got a story about this from Matt Williams. And here is your bonus story. And this is that humanity is slowing down the rotation of the planet. Now, not by much, but still, we are doing it. So you're probably familiar that the moon is drifting away from the Earth. It is tidally locked to the Earth. And because of this process, the Earth's rotation is slowing down by a handful of milliseconds per century. But there is another force that is acting on the Earth that is slowing down its rotation. And that is the redistribution of material from the poles to the equator. And so what's going on? Well, because of global warming, we have additional ice melt that is happening at the poles of planet Earth. That stuff was locked at the poles. Now it is redistributing around the equator because, of course, the Earth is spinning. It's like a flattened, it's an oblate spheroid. And so that is changing the rotation rate. And in fact, this is contributing to slow the Earth's rotation by 1.33 milliseconds per century. A fascinating part of this story is that scientists have been able to figure out what was the historical seashores over the last several million years. It's a certain kind of marine snail that they find at the seabed that tells them, oh, there was a shoreline here in the past. And they can calculate how quickly the shoreline was changing over time. And there's been times when the shoreline has been higher than we have it today and times when the shoreline was way lower than we have it today, but it has never moved as quickly as it is moving today. And that is just another piece of evidence that humanity is changing the temperature of our planet. And we are performing an experiment on our climate to which we do not know how this is going to turn out. And we've got a story about this from Mark Thompson. And of course, what we're talking about here on Space Bites this week, this is just a fraction of all the stories that we're covering over on Universe Today, typically between 30 and 40 stories every single week. And if you want to have it all gathered in one place, I write a weekly email newsletter that I send out to 70,000 of my closest friends. It's completely free. I write every single word in the newsletter. There's no ads. You can sign up, go to universetoday.com/newsletter. I'm going to talk about the surprising number of interviews that we have here on the channel. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrea Pedretti, Barely Griffin, Brian Bode, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielak, Cooper Nelly, Dark Finger, David Gilson, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Janice Smith, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Ring Kaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Found the Money, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Shiplin, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zeldaborg Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I got a comment a couple of days ago about someone who was surprised that there was an interview with Dr. Matt O'Dowd from PBS Spacetime, who is one of the most beloved channels in the space here on YouTube. And in fact, this is the second time that Matt and I have done a collaboration. In this case, I was interviewing him about his work as a black hole researcher. And it's a, you know, you will not be surprised to find out he has some really great ideas about how we can study black holes. And there's something very strange about YouTube, which is that they don't give a lot of emphasis to the interviews that we do. And yet when I talk to the patrons directly, they tell me that the interviews are their favorite part of the channel. It is what I consider to be the most valuable work that we're doing here on YouTube, that we're doing actual journalism. I am reaching out to scientists that are doing the research and helping deliver their research to you in their own words. And I'm not trying to summarize it. You're just hearing directly from them. We get this comment from people all the time where they've stumbled across one of our older interviews. They didn't realize that we had done this, and yet they really enjoy the topic. I mean, we have interviews with Nobel Prize winners, interviews with the architect of James Webb Space Telescope and the upcoming Habitable Worlds Observatory. Like, the list goes on. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews. Now, we've got a playlist here on the channel where you can go through all of the interviews that we've done and find ones that strike your fancy. And we also have a collection over on Patreon with all of the interviews there as well. And of course, the ones on Patreon, they have a little more content, longer interviews, more questions, other topics that we consider. And of course, all of those are completely free. And so if you just want to really bring yourself up to speed with the cutting edge of what's happening in space and astronomy, check out these interviews, put one on in the background while you are doing work or programming or whatever, and you will, I'm sure, find them really interesting. They're the most interesting part of this channel for me, and I know for a lot of people they are as well. All right, we'll see you next week.